"What happened here?" he asked. "Is this..." Before he could finish, a shout came from downstairs in the coop. "Hey, fuckface! I got you, didn't I? I got you good!" And then, incredibly, laughter. It was high-pitched and maniacal. For a moment, Jackie and Romy could only stare at each other, unable to move. Then Romy said, "I think that's Barbara." 29. Ernie Calvert sat behind the wheel of the phone company van, which was idling at a curb stenciled "Police Business 10 minutes only." He had locked all the doors, afraid of being carjacked by one or more of the panic-stricken people fleeing down Main Street from the town hall. He was holding the rifle Romy had stowed behind the driver's seat, although he wasn't sure he could shoot anybody who tried to break in. He knew these people, had for years sold them their groceries. Terror had rendered their faces strange, but not unrecognizable. He saw Henry Morrison coursing back and forth on the town hall lawn, looking like a hunting dog searching for scent. He was shouting into his bullhorn and trying to bring a little order out of the chaos. Someone knocked him over and Henry got right back up, God bless him. And now here were others. Georgie Frederick, Marty Arsenal, the Searles kid, recognizable by the bandage he was still wearing on his head, both Bowie brothers, Roger Killian, and a couple of the other newbies. Freddie Denton was marching down the hall's broad front steps with his gun drawn. Ernie didn't see Randolph, although anyone who didn't know better would have expected the chief of police to be in charge of the pacification detail, which was itself teetering on the edge of chaos. Ernie did know better. Peter Randolph had always been an ineffectual blusterbug, and his absence at this particular snafu circus did not surprise Ernie in the least, or concern him. What did concern him was that no one was coming out of the police department, and there had been more gunshots. These were muffled, as if they'd originated downstairs where the prisoners were kept. Not ordinarily a praying fellow, Ernie prayed now that none of the people fleeing the town hall would notice the old man behind the wheel of the idling van, that Jackie and Romy would come out safe with or without Barbara and Everett. It occurred to him that he could just drive away, and was shocked by how tempting the idea was. His cell phone rang. For a moment he just sat there, not sure of what he was hearing, and then he yanked it off his belt. When he opened it, he saw Joni in the window. But it wasn't his daughter-in-law, it was Nori.
"Grandpa, are you all right?"
"Fine," he said, looking at the chaos in front of him.
"Did you get them out?"
"It's happening right now, honey," he said, hoping it was the truth. "I can't talk. Are you safe? Are you at the place?"
"Yes. Grampy, it glows at night. The radiation belt. The cars glowed too, but then they stopped. Julia says she thinks it isn't dangerous. She says she thinks it's a fake, to scare people away."
"You better not count on that," Ernie thought. Two more muffled, thudding gunshots came from inside the PD. Someone was dead downstairs in the coop. Just about had to be.
"Nori, I can't talk now."
"Is it gonna be all right, Grandpa?"
"Yes, yes, I love you, Nori."
He closed the phone. It glows, he thought, and wondered if he would ever see that glow. Black Ridge was close. In a small town, everything's close. But just now it seemed far away. He looked at the PD's doors, trying to will his friends to come out. And when they didn't, he climbed from the van. He couldn't just sit out here any longer. He had to go inside and see what was happening. 30. Barbie saw Junior raise the gun. He heard Junior tell Rusty to close his eyes. He shouted without thinking, with no idea of what he was going to say, until the words emerged from his mouth. "Hey, fuckface, I got you, didn't I? I got you good." The laughter that followed sounded like the laugh of a lunatic who has been ditching his meds. "So that's how I laugh when I'm fixing to die," Barbie thought. "I'll have to remember that." Which made him laugh harder. Junior turned toward him. The right side of his face registered surprise. The left was frozen in a scowl. It reminded Barbie of some supervillain he'd read about in his youth, but he couldn't remember which. Probably one of Batman's enemies. They were always the creepiest. Then he remembered that when his little brother Wendell tried to say enemies, it came out enemas. This made him laugh harder than ever. There could be worse ways to go out, he thought, as he reached both hands through the bars and shot Junior a nice double bird. Remember Stubbs and Moby Dick? Whatever my fate, I'll go to it laughing. Junior saw Barbie giving him the finger in stereo and forgot all about Rusty. He started down the short corridor with his gun held out in front of him. Barbie's senses were very clear now, but he didn't trust them. The people he thought he heard moving around and speaking upstairs were almost surely just his imagination. Still, you played your string out to the end. If nothing else, he could give Rusty a few more breaths, and a little more time.
There you are, fuckface, he said. Remember how I cleaned your clock that night in Dippers? You cried like a little bitch.
I didn't.
It came out sounding like an exotic special on a Chinese menu. Junior's face was a wreck. Blood from his left eye was dribbling down one stubble darkened cheek. It occurred to Barbie that he might just have a chance here. Not a good one, but bad chances were better than no chances. He began to pace from side to side in front of his bunk and his toilet, slowly at first, then faster. Now you know what a mechanical duck in a shooting gallery feels like, he thought. I'll have to remember that, too. Junior followed his movements with his one good eye.
Did you fuck her? Do you fuck Angie?
Barbie laughed. It was the crazy laugh, one he still didn't recognize as his own. But there was nothing counterfeit about it.
Did I fuck her? Did I fuck her? Junior, I fucked her with her right side up, her upside down, and her backside all present and accounted for. I fucked her until she sang Hail to the Chief and Bad Moon Rising. I fucked her until she pounded on the floor and yelled for a whole lot more.
Junior tilted his head toward the gun. Barbie saw it and jigged to the left without delay. Junior fired. The bullet struck the brick wall at the back of the cell. Dark red chips flew. Some hit the bars. Barbie heard the metallic rattle like peas in a tin cup, even with the gunshot ringing in his ears. But none of them hit Junior. Shit. From down the hall, Rusty yelled something, probably trying to distract Junior, but Junior was done being distracted. Junior had his prime target in his sights. Not yet you don't, Barbie thought. He was still laughing. It was crazy, nuts, but there it was. Not quite yet, you ugly one-eyed motherfucker.
She said you couldn't get it up, Junior. She called you a limp dick supremo. We used to laugh about that while we were...
He leaped to the right at the same instant Junior fired. This time he heard the bullet pass the side of his head. The sound was zzz. More brick chips jumped. One stung the back of Barbie's neck.
Come on, Junior, what's wrong with you? You shoot like woodchucks do algebra. You a head case? That's what Angie and Frankie always used to say.
Barbie faked to the right and then ran at the left side of the cell. Junior fired three times, the explosions deafening, the stink of the blown gunpowder rich and strong. Two of the bullets buried themselves in brick. The third hit the metal toilet low down with a spang sound. Water began to pour out. Barbie struck the far wall of the cell hard enough to rattle his teeth.
Got you now. Junior panted.
But deep down in what remained of his overheated thinking engine, he wondered. His left eye was blind and his right one had blurred over. He saw not one Barbie, but three. The hateful son of a bitch hit the deck as Junior fired, and this bullet also missed. A small black eye opened in the center of the pillow at the head of the bunk. But at least he was down. No more jigging and jogging. Thank God I put in that fresh clip, Junior thought.
You poisoned me, Barbie.
Barbie had no idea what he was talking about, but agreed at once.
That's right, you loathsome little fuck puppet, I sure did.
Junior pushed the Beretta through the bars and closed his bad left eye. That reduced the number of Barbies he saw to just a pair. His tongue was snared between his teeth. His face ran with blood and sweat.
Let's see you run now, Barbie.
Barbie couldn't run, but he could and did crawl, scuttling right at Junior. The next bullet whistled over his head, and he felt a vague burn across one buttock as the slug split his jeans and undershorts and removed the top layer of skin beneath them. Junior recoiled, tripped, almost went down, caught the bars of the cell on his right, and hauled himself back up.
Hold still, motherfucker!
Barbie whirled to the bunk and groped beneath it for the knife. He had forgotten all about the fucking knife.
You want it in the back?
Junior asked from behind him.
Okay, that's all right with me.
Get him! Rusty shouted. Get him! Get him!
Before the next gunshot came, Barbie had just time to think, Jesus Christ, Everett, whose side are you on? 31. Jackie came down the stairs with Romy behind her. She had time to register the haze of gun smoke drifting around the caged overhead lights and the stink of expended powder, and then Rusty Everett was screaming, Get him! Get him! She saw Junior Rennie at the end of the corridor, crowding against the bars of the cell at the far end, the one the cops sometimes called the Ritz. He was screaming something, but it was all garbled. She didn't think. Nor did she tell Junior to raise his hands and turn around. She just put two in his back. One entered his right lung, the other pierced his heart. Junior was dead before he slid to the floor with his face pressed between two bars of the cell. His eyes pulled up so stringently he looked like a Japanese death mask. What his collapsing body revealed was Dale Barbara himself, crouching on his bunk with the carefully secreted knife in his hand. He had never had a chance to open it. 32. Freddie Denton grabbed Officer Henry Morrison's shoulder. Denton was not his favorite person tonight, and was never going to be his favorite person again. Not that he ever was, Henry thought sourly. Denton pointed.
Why is that old fool Calvert going into the PD? How the hell should I know?
Henry asked, and grabbed Donnie Barabo as Donnie ran by, shouting some senseless shit about terrorists.
Slow down, Henry bellowed into Donnie's face. It's all over. Everything's cool.
Donnie had been cutting Henry's hair and telling the same stale jokes twice a month for 10 years. But now he looked at Henry as if at a total stranger. Then he tore free and ran in the direction of East Street where his shop was. Perhaps he meant to take refuge there.
No civilians got any business being in the PD tonight, Freddie said.
Mel Searles steamed up beside him.
Well, why don't you go check him out, killer, Henry said. Take this lug with you, because neither of you are doing the slightest bit of damn good here. She was going for the gun, Freddie said for the first of what would be many times. And I didn't mean to kill her, only wing her-like.
Henry had no intention of discussing it.
Go in there and tell the old guy to leave. You can also make sure nobody's trying to free the prisoners while we're out here running around like a bunch of chickens with their heads cut off.
A light dawned in Freddie Denton's dazed eyes.
The prisoners! Mel, let's go!
They started away, only to be frozen by Henry's bullhorn amplified voice 3 yards behind them.
And put away those guns, you idiots!
Freddie did as the amplified voice commanded. Mel did the same. They crossed War Memorial Plaza and trotted up the PD steps with their guns holstered, which was probably a very good thing for Nori's grandfather. 33. Blood everywhere, Ernie thought, just as Jackie had. He stared at the carnage, dismayed, and then forced himself to move. Everything inside the reception desk had spilled out when Rupe Libby hit it. Lying amid the litter was a red plastic rectangle which he prayed the people downstairs might still be able to put to use. He was bending down to get it, and telling himself not to throw up, telling himself it was still a lot better than the Ashau Valley in Nam. When someone behind him said,
Holy fucking God, in the morning, stand up, Calvert, slow. Hands over your head.
But Freddie and Mel were still reaching for their weapons when Romy came up the stairs to search for what Ernie had already found. Romy had the speed pump black shadow he'd put away in his safe, and he pointed it at the two cops without a moment's hesitation.
You fine fellows might as well come all the way in, he said, and stay together, shoulder to shoulder. If I see light between you, I'll shoot. Ain't fucking the dog on this, me.
Put that down, Freddie said. We're police.
Prime assholes is what you are. Stand over there against that bulletin board,
and keep rubbing shoulders while you do it. Ernie, what the damn hell you doing in here?
I heard shooting. I was worried.
He held up the red key card that opened the cells in the coop.
You'll need this, I think, unless they're dead.
They ain't dead, but it was fucking close. Take it down to Jackie, I'll watch these fellas.
You can't release him, the prisoners, Mel said. Bobby's a murderer, the other one tried to frame Mr. Rennie with some papers, something like that.
Romy didn't bother replying.
Go on, honey, hurry.
What happens to us? Freddie asked. You ain't gonna kill us, are you?
Why would I kill you, Freddie? You still owe on that rototiller you bought for me last spring. Behind in payments, too, is my recollection. No, we'll just lock you in the coop. See how you like it down there. Smells kind of pissy, but who knows, you might like it.
Did you have to kill Mickey?
Mel asked.
He wasn't nothing but a soft-headed boy.
We didn't kill none of them, Romy said. Your good pal Junior did that.
Not that anybody will believe it come tomorrow night, he thought.
Junior?
Freddy exclaimed.
Where is he?
Shoveling coal down in hell would be my guess, Romy said. That's where they put the new help.
34. Barbie, Rusty, Jackie, and Ernie came upstairs. The two erstwhile prisoners looked as if they did not quite believe they were still alive. Romy and Jackie escorted Freddy and Mel down to the coop. When Mel saw Junior's crumpled body, he said,
You'll be sorry for this.
Romy said,
Shut your hole and get in your new home. Both in the same cell, you chums, after all.
As soon as Romy and Jackie had returned to the top floor, the two men began to holler.
Well, let's get out of here while we still can, Ernie said.
35. On the steps, Rusty looked up at the pink stars and breathed air which stank and smelled incredibly sweet at the same time.
He turned to Barbie. I never expected to see the sky again.
Neither did I. Let's blow town while we've got the chance. How does Miami Beach sound to you? Rusty was still laughing when he got into the van. Several cops were on the town hall lawn, and one of them, Todd Wendelstadt, looked over. Ernie raised his hand in a wave. Romy and Jackie followed suit. Wendelstadt returned the wave, then bent to help a woman who had gone sprawling to the grass when her high heels betrayed her. Ernie slid behind the wheel and mated the electrical wires hanging below the dashboard. The engine started, the side door slammed shut, and the van pulled away from the curb. It rolled slowly up Town Common Hill, weaving around a few stunned meeting-goers who were walking in the street. Then they were out of downtown and headed toward Black Ridge, picking up speed.
Ants.
1. They started seeing the glow on the other side of a rusty old bridge that now spanned nothing but a mudslick. Barbie leaned forward between the front seats of the van.
What's that?
It looks like the world's biggest indiglow watch.
It's radiation, Ernie said. Don't worry, Romy said. We've got plenty of lead roll.
Nora called me on her mother's cell phone while I was waiting for you, Ernie said. She told me about the glow. She says Julia thinks it's nothing but a kind of scarecrow, I guess you'd say, not dangerous.
I thought Julia's degree was in journalism, not science, Jackie said. She's a very nice lady and smart, but we're still going to armor this thing up, right? Because I don't much fancy getting ovarian or breast cancer as a 40th birthday present.
We'll drive fast, Romy said. You can even slide a piece of that lead roll down the front of your jeans if it'll make you feel better, you.
That's so funny I forgot to laugh, she said. Then did just that, when she got an image of herself in lead panties, fashionably high-cut on the sides. They came to the dead bear at the foot of the telephone pole. They could have seen it even with the headlights off, because by then the combined light from the pink moon and the radiation belt was almost strong enough to read a newspaper by. While Romy and Jackie covered the van's windows with lead roll, the others stood around the rotting bear in a semicircle. Not radiation, Barbie mused.
Nope, Rusty said. Suicide. And there are others.
Yes, but the smaller animals seem to be safe. The kids and I saw plenty of birds, and there was a squirrel in the orchard. It was just as lively as can be.
Then Julia's almost certainly right, Barbie said. The glow band's a scarecrow, and the dead animals are another. It's the old belt and suspenders thing.
I'm not following you, my friend, Ernie said.
But Rusty, who had learned the belt and suspenders approach as a medical student, absolutely was. Two warnings to keep out, he said. Dead animals by day, a glowing belt of radiation by night.
So far as I know, Romy said, joining them at the side of the road, radiation only glows in science fiction movies.
Rusty thought of telling him they were living in a science fiction movie, and Romy would realize it when he got close to that weird box on the ridge. But of course, Romy was right.
We're supposed to see it, he said. The same with the dead animals. You're supposed to say, Whoa, if there's some kind of suicide ray out here that affects big mammals, I better stay away. After all, I'm a big mammal.
But the kids didn't back off, Barbie said.
Because they're kids, Ernie said. And after a moment's consideration, also skateboarders. They're a different breed.
I still don't like it, Jackie said. But since we have no place else to go, maybe we could drive through yonder Van Allen belt before I lose what's left of my nerve. After what happened at the cop shop, I'm feeling a little shaky. Wait a minute, Barbie said. There's something out of kilter here. I see it, but give me a second to think how to say it.
They waited. Moonlight and radiation lit the remains of the bear. Barbie was staring at it.
Finally, he raised his head.
Okay, here's what's troubling me. There's a they. We know that because the box Rusty found isn't a natural phenomenon.
Damn straight, it's a made thing, Rusty said. But not terrestrial, I'd bet my life on that.
Then he thought how close he'd come to losing his life not an hour ago and shuddered. Jackie squeezed his shoulder.
Never mind that part for now, Barbie said. There's a they, and if they really wanted to keep us out, they could. They're keeping the whole world out of Chester's Mill. If they wanted to keep us away from their box, why not put a mini dome around it?
Or a harmonic sound that would cook our brains like chicken legs in a microwave, Rusty suggested, getting into the spirit of the thing. Hell, real radiation for that matter.
It might be real radiation, Ernie said. In fact, the Geiger counter you brought up here pretty much confirmed that.
Yes, Barbie agreed, but does that mean that what the Geiger counter's registering is dangerous? Rusty and the kids aren't breaking out in lesions or losing their hair or vomiting up the linings of their stomachs?
At least not yet, Jackie said.
That's cheerful, Romy said.
Barbie ignored the byplay.
Surely if they can create a barrier so strong it bounces back the best missiles America can throw at it, they could set up a radiation belt that would kill quickly, maybe instantly. It would even be in their interest to do so. A couple of grisly human deaths would be a lot more apt to discourage explorers than a bunch of dead animals.
No, I think Julia's right. And the so-called radiation belt will turn out to be a harmless glow that's been spiced up to register on our detection equipment, which probably seems pretty damn primitive to them, if they really are extraterrestrial.
But why? Rusty burst out. Why any barrier? I couldn't lift the damn thing. I couldn't even rock it. And when I put a lead apron on it, the apron caught fire, even though the box itself is cool to the touch.
If they're protecting it, there must be some way of destroying it or turning it off, Jackie said. Except... Barbie was smiling at her. He felt strange, almost as if he were floating above his own head. Go on, Jackie. Say it. Except they're not protecting it, are they? Not from people who are determined to approach it.
There's more, Barbie said. Couldn't we say they're actually pointing at it?
Joe McClatchy and his friends were practically following a trail of breadcrumbs.
Here it is, puny earthlings, Rusty said. What can you do about it, ye who are brave enough to approach?
That feels about right, Barbie said. Come on, let's get up there. 2.
You better let me drive from here, Rusty told Ernie. Up ahead's where the kids passed out.
Romy almost did.
I felt it too, and I had a kind of hallucination. A Halloween dummy that burst into flames.
Another warning? Ernie asked.
I don't know.
Rusty drove to where the woods ended, and open rocky land sloped up to the McCoy orchard. Just ahead the air glowed so brightly they had to squint. But there was no source. The brightness was just there, floating. To Barbie, it looked like the sort of light fireflies give off, only magnified a million times. The belt appeared to be about 50 yards wide. Beyond it, the world was again dark, except for the pink glow of the moonlight.
You sure that faintness won't happen to you again? Barbie asked.
It seems to be like touching the dome the first time vaccinates you. Rusty settled behind the wheel, dropped the transmission into drive, and said, Hang on to your false teeth, ladies and germs. He hit the gas hard enough to spin the rear tires. The van sped into the glow. They were too well armored to see what happened next, but several people already on the ridge saw it from where they had been watching, with increasing anxiety, from the edge of the orchard. For a moment, the van was clearly visible, as if centered in a spotlight. When it ran out of the glow belt, it continued to shine for several seconds, as if the stolen van had been dipped with radium. And it dragged a fading cometary tail of brightness behind it, like exhaust.
Holy shit, Benny said. It's like the best special effect I ever saw.
Then the glow around the van faded, and the tail disappeared. 3. As they passed through the glow belt, Barbie felt a momentary lightheadedness, no more than that. For Ernie, the real world of this van and these people seemed to be replaced by a hotel room that smelled of pine and roared with the sound of Niagara Falls. And here was his wife of just 12 hours coming to him, wearing a nightgown that was really no more than a breath of lavender smoke, taking his hands and putting them on her breasts and saying, "This time we don't have to stop, honey." Then he heard Barbie shouting, and that brought him back. "Rusty, she's having some kind of fit. Stop." Ernie looked around and saw Jackie Weddington shaking, her eyes rolled up in their sockets, her fingers splayed. "He's holding up a cross and everything's burning," she screamed. Spittle sprayed from her lips. "The world is burning. The people are burning," she let loose a shriek that filled the van. Rusty almost ditched the van, pulled back into the middle of the road, leaped out, and ran around to the side door. By the time Barbie slid it open, Jackie was wiping spit from her chin with a cupped hand. Romy had his arm around her. "You all right?" Rusty asked her. "No, yes, everything was on fire. It was day, but it was dark. People were burning." She started to cry. "You said something about a man with a cross," Barbie said. "A big, white cross. It was on a string or a piece of rawhide. It was on his chest, his bare chest. Then he held it up in front of his face." She drew in a deep breath, lit it out in little hitches. "It's all fading now, but who?" Rusty held two fingers up in front of her and asked how many she saw. Jackie gave the correct answer and followed his thumb when he moved it, first from side to side, then up and down. He patted her on the shoulder, then looked mistrustfully back at the glow belt. What was it Gollum had said of Bilbo Baggins? "It's Trixie, precious." "What about you, Barbie, okay?" "Yeah. A little lightheaded for a few seconds, that's all." "Ernie?" "I saw my wife. And the hotel room we stayed in on our honeymoon. It was as clear as day." He thought again of her coming to him. He hadn't thought of that in years. And what a shame to neglect such an excellent memory. The whiteness of her thighs below her shorty nightgown. The neat dark triangle of her pubic hair. Her nipples hard against silk, almost seeming to scrape the pads of his palms as she darted her tongue into his mouth and licked the inner lining of his lower lip. "This time we don't have to stop, honey." Ernie leaned back and closed his eyes. 4. Rusty drove up the ridge, slowly now, and parked the van between the barn and the dilapidated farmhouse. The Sweetbriar Rose van was there. The Burpees department store van. Also a Chevrolet Malibu. Julia had parked her Prius inside the barn. Horace the Corgi sat by its rear bumper as if guarding it. He did not look like a happy canine, and he made no move to come and greet them. Inside the farmhouse, a couple of Coleman lanterns glowed. Jackie pointed at the van with "Every day is sale day at Burpees" on the side. "How'd that get here? Did your wife change her mind?" Romy grinned.
"You don't know Misha if you ever think that. No, I got Julia to thank. She recruited her two star reporters, those guys."
He broke off as Julia Piper and Lissa Jameson appeared from the moonlit shadows of the orchard. They were stumbling along, three abreast, holding hands, and all of them were crying. Barbie ran to Julia and took her by the shoulders. She was on the end of their little line, and the flashlight she had been holding in her free hand dropped to the weedy dirt of the dooryard. She looked up at him and made an effort to smile. "So, they got you out, Colonel Barbara. That's one for the home team." "What happened to you?" Barbie asked. Now Joe, Benny, and Nori came running up with their mothers close behind them. The kids' shouts cut short when they saw the state the three women were in. Horace ran to his mistress, barking. Julia went to her knees and buried her face in his fur. Horace sniffed her, then suddenly backed away. He sat down and howled. Julia looked at him and then covered her face as if in shame. Nori had grabbed Joe's hand on her left and Benny's on her right. Their faces were solemn and scared. Pete Freeman, Tony Gay, and Rose Twitchell came out of the farmhouse but did not approach. They stood clustered by the kitchen door.
"We went to look
at it, Lissa said dully. Her usual gosh, the world is wonderful brightness was gone. We knelt around it. There's a symbol on it I've never seen before. It's not Kabbalah. It's awful, Piper said, wiping at her eyes. And then Julia touched it. She was the only one, but we all.
Did you see them? Rusty asked. Julia dropped her hands and looked at him with something like wonder.
Yes, I did. We all did. Them. Horrible.
The Leatherheads, Rusty said.
What?
Piper said. Then she nodded.
Yes. I suppose you could call them that. Faces without faces. High faces.
High faces, Rusty thought. He didn't know what it meant, but he knew it was true. He thought again of his daughters and their friend Deanna exchanging secrets and snacks. Then he thought of his best childhood friend, for a while anyway. He and Georgie had fallen out violently in second grade. And horror rolled over him in a wave. Barbie grabbed him.
What? He was almost shouting. What is it?
Nothing. Only, I had this friend when I was little, George Lathrop. One year, he got a magnifying glass for his birthday, and sometimes, at recess, we...
Rusty helped Julia to her feet. Horace had come back to her, as if whatever had scared him was fading like the glow had faded on the van.
You did what? Julia asked.
She sounded almost calm again.
Tell.
This was at the old Main Street Grammar, just two rooms. One for grades 1 to 4, the other for 5 to 8. The playground wasn't paved.
He laughed shakily.
Hell, there wasn't even running water, just a privy the kids called...
The Honey House, Julia said. I went there, too.
George and I, we'd go past the monkey bars to the fence. There were anthills there, and we'd set the ants on fire.
Don't take on about it, Doc, Ernie said. Lots of kids have done that, and worse.
Ernie himself, along with a couple of friends, had once dipped a stray cat's tail in kerosene and put a match to it. This was a memory he would share with the others no more than he would tell them about the details of his wedding night. Mostly because of how we laughed when that cat took off, he thought. Gosh, how we did laugh.
Go on, Julia said.
I'm done.
You're not, she said.
Look, said Joni Calvert, I'm sure this is all very psychological, but I don't think this is the time.
Hush, Joni, Claire said.
Julia had never taken her eyes from Rusty's face.
What does it matter to you? Rusty asked.
He felt at that moment as though there were no onlookers, as if it were only the two of them.
Just tell me.
One day, while we were doing that, it occurred to me that the ants also have their little lives. I know that sounds like sentimental slop.
Barbie said millions of people all over the world believe that very thing. They live by it.
Anyway, I thought, we're hurting them. We're burning them on the ground and maybe broiling them alive in their underground houses. About the ones who were getting the direct benefit of Georgie's magnifying glass, there was no question. Some just stopped moving, but most actually caught fire.
That's awful, Lissa said.
She was twisting her ankh again.
Yes, ma'am. And this one day, I told Georgie to stop. He wouldn't. He said, it's jucular war. I remember that. Not nuclear, but jucular. I tried to take the magnifying glass away from him. Next thing you know, we were fighting and his magnifying glass got broken. He stopped. That's not the truth. Although it's what I said at the time, and not even the hiding my father gave me could make me change my story. The one George told his folks was the true one. I broke the goddamn thing on purpose. He pointed into the dark. The way I'd break that box if I could. Because now we're the ants, and that's the magnifying glass. Ernie thought again of the cat with the burning tail. Claire McClatchy remembered how she and her third-grade best friend had sat on a bawling girl they both hated. The girl was new in school and had a funny southern accent that made her sound like she was talking through mashed potatoes. The more the new girl cried, the harder they laughed. Romeo Burpee remembered getting drunk the night Hillary Clinton cried in New Hampshire, toasting the TV screen and saying, "That's it for you, you goddamn baby. Get out of the way and let a man do a man's job." Barbie remembered a certain gymnasium. The desert heat, the smell of shit, and the sound of laughter.
I want to see it for myself, he said. Who'll go with me? Rusty sighed. I will. 5. While Barbie and Rusty were approaching the box with its strange symbol and brilliant pulsing light, Selectman James Rennie was in the cell where Barbie had been imprisoned until earlier this evening. Carter Thibodeau had helped him lift Junior's body onto the bunk.
Leave me with him, Big Jim said.
Boss, I know how bad you must feel, but there are 100 things that need your attention right now.
I'm aware of that, and I'll take care of them, but I need a little time with my son first. 5 minutes. Then you can get a couple of fellows to take him to the funeral parlor.
All right. I'm sorry for your loss. Junior was a good guy.
No, he wasn't, Big Jim said.
He spoke in a mild, just telling it like it is tone of voice.
But he was my son, and I loved him. And this isn't all bad, you know.
Carter considered.
I know.
Big Jim smiled.
I know you know. I'm starting to think you're the son I should have had.
Carter's face flushed with pleasure as he trotted up the stairs to the ready room. When he was gone, Big Jim sat on the bunk and lowered Junior's head into his lap. The boy's face was unmarked and Carter had closed his eyes. If you ignored the blood matting his shirt, he could have been sleeping. He was my son, and I loved him. It was true. He had been ready to sacrifice Junior, yes, but there was precedent for that. You only had to look at what happened on Calvary Hill. And like Christ, the boy had died for a cause. Whatever damage had been caused by Andrew Grinnell's raving would be repaired when the town realized that Barbie had killed several dedicated police officers, including their leader's only child. Barbie on the loose and presumably planning new deviltry was a political plus. Big Jim sat a while longer, combing Junior's hair with his fingers and looking raptly into Junior's reposeful face. Then, under his breath, he sang to him as his mother had when the boy was an infant, lying in his crib, looking up at the world with wide, wondering eyes.
Baby boats, a silver moon, sailing o'er the sky, sailing o'er the sea of dew, while the clouds float by. Sail, baby, sail, out across the sea.
There he stopped. He couldn't remember the rest. He lifted Junior's head and stood up. His heart did a jagged turrididdle, and he held his breath. But then it settled again. He supposed he would eventually have to get some more of that Verapa what's-this from Andy's pharmacy supplies. But in the meantime, there was work to do. 6. He left Junior and went slowly up the stairs, holding the railing. Carter was in the ready room. The bodies had been removed, and a double spread of newspapers was soaking up Mickey Wardlaw's blood.
Let's go over to the town hall before this place fills up with cops, he told Carter. Visitor's Day officially starts in, he looked at his watch, about 12 hours. We've got a lot to do before then.
I know.
And don't forget my son. I want the Bowies to do it right, a respectful presentation of the remains in a fine coffin. You tell Stewart if I see Junior one of those cheap things from out back, I'll kill him.
Carter was scribbling in his notebook.
I'll take care of it.
And tell Stewart that I'll be talking to him soon.
Several officers came in the front door. They looked subdued, a little scared, very young and green. Big Jim heaved himself out of the chair he'd been sitting in while he recovered his breath.
Time to move.
Okay by me, Carter said.
But he paused. Big Jim looked around.
Something on your mind, son?
Son. Carter liked the sound of that son. His own father had been killed 5 years previous when he crashed his pickup into one of the twin bridges in Leeds. And no great loss. He had abused his wife and both sons. Carter's older brother was currently serving in the Navy. But Carter didn't care about that so much. His mother had her coffee brandy to numb her up, and Carter himself had always been able to take a few licks. No, what he hated about the old man was that he was a whiner. And he was stupid. People assumed Carter was also stupid. Hell, even Junes had assumed it. But he wasn't. Mr. Rennie understood that. And Mr. Rennie was sure no whiner. Carter discovered that he was no longer undecided about what to do next.
I've got something you may want.
Is that so?
Big Jim had preceded Carter downstairs, giving Carter a chance to visit his locker. He opened it now and took out the envelope with Vader printed on it. He held it out to Big Jim. The bloody footprint stamped on it seemed to glare. Big Jim opened the clasp.
Jim,
Peter Randolph said. He had come in unnoticed and was standing by the overturned reception desk looking exhausted.
I think we've got things quieted down, but I can't find several of the new officers. I think they may have quit on us.
To be expected, Big Jim said, and temporary. They'll be back when things settle and they realize Dale Barbara isn't going to lead a gang of bloodthirsty cannibals into town to eat them alive.
But with this damned Visitor's Day thing...
Almost everyone's going to be on their best behavior tomorrow, Pete, and I'm sure we'll have enough officers to take care of any who aren't.
What do we do about the press con... Do you see I happen to be a little busy here? Do you see that, Pete? Goodness!
Come over to the town hall conference room in half an hour. We'll discuss anything you want, but for now, leave me the heck alone.
Of course. Sorry.
Pete backed away, his body as stiff and offended as his voice.
Stop, Rennie said.
Randolph stopped.
You never offered me condolences on my son.
I'm very sorry.
Big Jim measured Randolph with his eyes.
Indeed you are.
When Randolph was gone, Rennie pulled the papers out of the envelope, looked at them briefly, then stuffed them back in. He looked at Carter with honest curiosity.
Why didn't you give this to me right away? Were you planning to keep it?
Now that he'd handed over the envelope, Carter saw no option but the truth.
Yeah. For a while, anyway, just in case.
In case of what?
Carter shrugged. Big Jim didn't pursue the question. As a man who routinely kept files on anyone and everyone who might cause him trouble, he didn't have to. There was another question that interested him more.
Why did you change your mind?
Carter once again saw no option but the truth.
Because I want to be your guy, boss.
Big Jim hoisted his bushy eyebrows.
Do you? More than him?
He jerked his head toward the door Randolph had just walked out of.
Him? He's a joke.
Yes. Big Jim dropped a hand on Carter's shoulder. He is. Come on.
And once we get over there to the town hall, burning these papers in the conference room wood stove will be our first order of business. 7.
They were indeed high and horrible. Barbie saw them as soon as the shock passing up his arms faded. His first strong impulse was to let go of the box, but he fought it and held on, looking at the creatures who were holding them prisoner, holding them and torturing them for pleasure. If Rusty was right. Their faces, if they were faces, were all angles, but the angles were padded and seemed to change from moment to moment, as if the underlying reality had no fixed form. He couldn't tell how many of them there were or where they were. At first he thought there were 4, then 8, then only 2. They inspired a deep sense of loathing in him, perhaps because they were so alien he could not really perceive them at all. The part of his brain tasked with interpreting sensory input could not decode the messages his eyes were sending. My eyes couldn't see them, not really, even with a telescope. These creatures are in a galaxy far, far away.
There was no way to know that. Reason told him the owners of the box might have a base under the ice at the South Pole, or might be orbiting the moon in their version of the Starship Enterprise. But he did. They were at home. Whatever home was for them. They were watching, and they were enjoying. They had to be, because the sons of bitches were laughing. Then he was back in the gym in Fallujah. It was hot because there was no air conditioning, just overhead fans that paddled the soupy, jock-smelling air around and around. They had let all the interrogation subjects go except for 2 Abduls, who were unwise enough to snot off a day after 2 IEDs had taken 6 American lives. And a sniper had taken 1 more. A kid from Kentucky everyone liked. Carstairs. So they'd started kicking the Abduls around the gym and pulling off their clothes, and Barbie would like to say he had walked out, but he hadn't. He would like to say that at least he hadn't participated, but he had.
They got feverish about it. He remembered connecting with one Abdul's bony, shit-speckled ass, and the red mark his combat boot had left there. Both Abduls naked by then. He remembered Emerson kicking the other one's dangling cojones so hard they flew up in front of him and saying, "That's for Carstairs, you fucking sand nigger." Someone would soon be giving his mom a flag while she sat on a folding chair near the grave, same old, same old. And then, just as Barbie was remembering that he was technically in charge of these men, Sergeant Hackermeyer pulled one of them up by the unwinding remains of the hijab that was now his only clothing, and held him against the wall and put his gun to the Abdul's head, and there was a pause, and no one said no in the pause, and no one said don't do that in the pause, and Sergeant Hackermeyer pulled the trigger and the blood hit the wall as it's hit the wall for 3,000 years and more. And that was it. That was goodbye, Abdul. Don't forget to write when you're not busy cherry-popping those virgins. Barbie let go of the box and tried to get up, but his legs betrayed him. Rusty grabbed him and held him until he steadied. "Christ," Barbie said. "You saw them, didn't you?" "Yes." "Are they children? What do you think?" "Maybe." But that wasn't good enough, wasn't what his heart believed. "Probably." They walked slowly back to where the others were clustered in front of the farmhouse.
"You all right?" Romy asked.
"Yes," Barbie said. He had to talk to the kids. And Jackie. Rusty, too. But not yet. First he had to get himself under control.
"You sure?"
"Yes."
"Remy, is there more of that lead roll at your store?" Rusty asked.
"Yeah. I left it on the loading dock."
"Good," Rusty said, and borrowed Julia's cell phone.
He hoped Linda was home and not in an interrogation room at the PD. But hoping was all he could do. 8. The call from Rusty was necessarily brief, less than 30 seconds, but for Linda Everett it was long enough to turn this terrible Thursday 180 degrees towards sunshine. She sat at the kitchen table, put her hands to her face, and cried. She did it as quietly as possible because there were now 4 children upstairs instead of just 2. She had brought the Appleton kids home with her, so now she had the A's as well as the J's. Alice and Aiden had been terribly upset. Dear God, of course they had been. But being with Janny and Judy had helped. So had doses of Benadryl all around. At the request of her girls, Linda had spread sleeping bags in their room, and now all 4 of them were conked out on the floor between the beds, Judy and Aiden with their arms wrapped around each other. Just as she was getting herself under control again, there was a knock at the kitchen door. Her first thought was the police, although given the bloodshed and confusion downtown, she hadn't expected them so soon. But there was nothing authoritative about that soft rapping. She went to the door, pausing to snatch a dish towel from the end of the counter and wipe her face. At first she didn't recognize her visitor, mostly because his hair was different. It was no longer in a ponytail. It fell to Thurston Marshall's shoulders, framing his face, making him look like an elderly washerwoman who has gotten bad news, terrible news, after a long, hard day. Linda opened the door. For a moment, Thurst remained on the stoop.
"Is Caro dead?"
His voice was low and hoarse, as if he screamed it out at Woodstock doing the fish cheer and it just never came back, Linda thought.
"Is she really dead?"
"I'm afraid she is," Linda said, speaking low herself. "Because of the children. Mr. Marshall, I'm so sorry."
For a moment he continued to just stand there. Then he grabbed the gray locks hanging on either side of his face and began to rock back and forth. Linda didn't believe in May-December romances. She was old-fashioned that way. She would have given Marshall and Caro Sturges 2 years, at most, maybe only 6 months, however long it took their sex organs to stop smoking. But tonight, there was no doubting the man's love. Or his loss. Whatever they had, those kids deepened it, she thought. And the dome, too. Living under the dome intensified everything. Already it seemed to Linda that they had been under it, not for days, but years. The outside world was fading like a dream when you woke up.
"Come in," she said, "but be quiet, Mr. Marshall. The children are sleeping. Mine and yours."
9. She gave him sun tea. Not cold, not even particularly cool, but the best she could do under the circumstances. He drank half of it off, set the glass down, then screwed his fists into his eyes like a child up long past his bedtime. Linda recognized this for what it was, an effort to get himself under control, and sat quietly, waiting. He pulled in a deep breath, let it out, then reached into the breast pocket of the old blue work shirt he was wearing. He took out a piece of rawhide and tied his hair back. She took this as a good sign.
"Tell me what happened," Thirst said, "and how it happened."
"I didn't see it all. Someone kicked me a good one in the back of my head while I was trying to pull your... Caro out of the way."
"But one of the cops shot her. Isn't that right? One of the cops in this goddamn cop-happy, gun-happy town."
"Yes." She reached across the table and took his hand. "Someone shouted gun, and there was a gun. It was Andrea Grinnell's. She might have brought it to the meeting with the idea of assassinating Rennie."
"Do you think that justifies what happened to Caro?"
"God, no. And what happened to Andy was flat-out murder."
"Caro died trying to protect the children, didn't she?"
"Yes."
"Children that weren't even her own."
Linda said nothing.
"Except they were hers and mine. Call it fortunes of war, or fortunes of Dome. They were ours, the kids we never would have had otherwise. And until the Dome breaks, if it ever does, they're mine."
Linda was thinking furiously, could this man be trusted? She thought so. Certainly Rusty had trusted him. Had said the guy was a hell of a good medic for someone who'd been out of the game so long. And Thurston hated those in authority here under the Dome. He had reasons to.
"Mrs. Everett."
"Please, Linda."
"Linda, may I sleep on your couch? I'd like to be here if they wake up in the night. If they don't, I hope they don't. I'd like them to see me when they come downstairs in the morning."
"That's fine. We'll all have breakfast together. It'll be cereal. The milk hasn't turned yet, although it will soon."
"That sounds good. After the kids eat, we'll be out of your hair. Pardon me for saying this, if you're a homegirl, but I've had a belly full of Chester's Mill. I can't secede from it entirely, but I intend to do the best I can. The only patient at the hospital in serious condition was Rennie's son, and he checked himself out this afternoon. He'll be back. That mess growing on his head will make him come back, but for now..."
"He's dead." Thurston didn't look particularly surprised.
"A seizure, I suppose?"
"No. Shot. In the jail."
"I'd like to say I'm sorry, but I'm not."
"Neither am I," Linda said. She didn't know for sure what Junior had been doing there, but she had a good idea of how the grieving father would spin it.
"I'll take the kids back to the pond where Caro and I were staying when this happened. It's quiet there, and I'm sure I'll be able to find enough comestibles to last for a while, maybe quite a while. I may even find a place with a generator. But as far as community life goes..."
He gave the words a satiric spin.
"I'm quits. Alice and Aiden, too."
"I might have a better place to go."
"Really?"
And when Linda said nothing, he stretched a hand across the table and touched hers.
"You have to trust someone. It might as well be me."
So Linda told him everything, including how they'd have to stop for lead roll behind Burpees before leaving town for Black Ridge. They talked until almost midnight. 10. The north end of the McCoy farmhouse was useless. Thanks to the previous winter's heavy snow, the roof was now in the parlor. But there was a country-style dining room almost as long as a railroad car on the west side, and it was there that the fugitives from Chester's Mill gathered. Barbie first questioned Joe, Nori, and Benny about what they had seen or dreamed about when they passed out on the edge of what they were now calling the Glow Belt. Joe remembered burning pumpkins. Nori said everything had turned black and the sun was gone. Benny at first claimed to remember nothing. Then he clapped a hand over his mouth.
"There was screaming," he said. "I heard screaming. It was bad."
They considered this in silence. Then Ernie said, "Burning pumpkins doesn't narrow things down much, if that's what you're trying to do, Colonel Barbara. There's probably a stack of 'em on the sunny side of every barn in town. It's been a good season for 'em." He paused. "At least it was.
Rusty, what about your girls?"
Pretty much the same, Rusty said and told them what he could remember.
Stop Halloween, stop the Great Pumpkin, Romy mused.
Dudes, I'm seeing a pattern here, Benny said. No shit, Sherlock, Rose said, and they all laughed. Your turn, Rusty, Barbie said. How about when you passed out on your way up here?
I never exactly passed out, Rusty said, and all this stuff could be explained by the pressure we've been under. Group hysteria, including group hallucinations, are common when people are under stress.
Thank you, Dr. Freud, Barbie said. Now, tell us what you saw. Rusty got as far as the stovepipe hat with its patriotic stripes when Lissa Jameson exclaimed, That's the dummy on the library lawn. He's wearing an old T-shirt of mine with a Warren Zevon quote on it.
Sweet Home Alabama, play that dead band song, Rusty said, and garden trowels for hands. Anyway, it caught fire. Then poof, it was gone. So was the lightheadedness. He looked around at them, their wide eyes. Relax, people. I probably saw the dummy before all this happened, and my subconscious just coughed it back up.
He leveled a finger at Barbie. And if you call me Dr. Freud again, I'm apt to pop you one.
Did you see it before? Piper asked. Maybe when you went to pick up your girls at school or something? Because the library is right across from the playground.
Not that I remember, no.
Rusty didn't add that he hadn't picked up the girls at school since very early in the month, and he doubted that any of the town's Halloween displays had been up then.
Now you, Jackie, Barbie said. She wet her lips. Is it really so important?
I think it is.
People burning, she said, and smoke with fire shining through it whenever it shifted. The whole world seemed to be burning.
Yep, Benny said. The people were screaming because they were on fire. Now I remember.
Abruptly, he put his face against Alva Drake's shoulder. She put her arm around him.
Halloween's still 5 days away, Claire said.
Barbie said, I don't think so.
11. The wood stove in the corner of the town hall conference room was dusty and neglected but still usable. Big Jim made sure the flue was open. It squeaked rustily. Then removed Duke Perkins' paperwork from the envelope with the bloody footprint on it. He thumbed through the sheets, grimaced at what he saw, then tossed them into the stove. The envelope he saved. Carter was on the phone talking to Stuart Bowie, telling him what Big Jim wanted for his son, telling him to get on it right away. A good boy, Big Jim thought. He may go far, as long as he remembers which side his bread's buttered on, that is. People who forgot paid a price. Andrew Grinnell had found that out tonight. There was a box of wooden matches on the shelf beside the stove. Big Jim scratched one alight and touched it to the corner of Duke Perkins' evidence. He left the stove door open so he could watch it burn. It was very satisfying. Carter walked over.
Stuart Bowie's on hold. Should I tell him you'll get back to him later?
Give it to me, Big Jim said and held out his hand for the phone. Carter pointed at the envelope.
Don't you want to throw that in too?
No, I want you to stuff it with blank paper from the photocopy machine. It took a moment for Carter to get it.
She was just having a bunch of dope-ass hallucinations, wasn't she?
Poor woman, Big Jim agreed. Go down to the fallout shelter, son. There. He cocked his thumb at a door. Unobtrusive except for an old metal plaque showing black triangles against a yellow field, not far from the wood stove. There are two rooms. At the end of the second one, there's a small generator.
Okay.
In front of the Jenny, there's a trap door. Hard to see, but you will if you look. Lift it and look inside. There should be 8 or 10 little canisters of LP snuggled down in there. At least there were the last time I looked. Check. And tell me how many. He waited to see if Carter would ask why, but Carter didn't. He just turned to do as he was told. So, Big Jim told him. Only a precaution, son. Dot every I and cross every T. That's the secret of success. And having God on your side, of course. When Carter was gone, Big Jim pushed the hold button. And if Stuart wasn't still there, his butt was going to be in a high sling. Stuart was.
Jim, I'm so sorry for your loss, he said, right up front with it, a point in his favor. We'll take care of everything. I'm thinking the eternal rest casket. It's oak. Good for 1,000 years. Go on and pull the other one, Big Jim thought, but kept silent.